From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm producer Megan Mack. Our connection this hour began in August 1835, when a New York newspaper announced the alleged discovery of life on the moon. The newspaper claimed that a famous astronomer had found evidence of unicorns, two-legged beavers, and furry humans with large, bat-like wings living on the moon. And the article was one in a series of six. Each offered different descriptions, not only of the animals, but also of massive craters, enormous amethyst crystals, rushing rivers, and lush vegetation. Readers lapped it up, and sales of the newspaper rose considerably. But here's the problem. The story, of course, wasn't true. The articles were intended as satire and were written to poke fun at serious speculations about extraterrestrial life at the time. Now, since some readers were soaking up the story, they missed the point. Other readers knew the story was a hoax, but were willing to suspend their disbelief. So why do we believe, or want to believe, in hoaxes? And what is the relationship between seeing and believing? My guest this hour is writing a book that answers these questions. Joan Saab is an associate professor of art history and visual and cultural studies at the University of Rochester. Her book, Making Sense of What We See, Hoaxes in the American Visual Imagination, is part of a series that she calls a new type of history that engages all of the senses. She'll present some of her research tonight at 5 o'clock in the Hawkins Carlson Room of Rushery's Library at the University of Rochester. But first, she's here in studio with us today. Joan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, when we think of hoaxes, a number of examples immediately come to mind. And I know we've already had some people calling in wanting to speak about hoaxes. But just off the top of my head, the Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, the Cardiff Giant, P.T. Barnum's creatures. How did you first become interested in researching this belief in hoaxes?
Well, I became interested in this sort of proliferation of hoaxes in the mid-19th century as part of this project that I'm working on that you explained. And the larger project looks at, it's supposed to be a sensory history of visual culture. And I was approached by the press with this project, and I wasn't exactly sure what that meant, because the idea of sensory history is a history that engages multiple senses. And many of these other volumes in the series are responding to sight, because that's the privileged sense. So I said, how do you write a sensory history of the privileged sight, of the privileged sense? And so I started to think about the relationship between seeing and believing, and the notion, the things that are not really part of the modernist sort of rational, critical belief system, things like awe, things like wonder, things like pleasure. And I was looking at technologies, and I was really interested in technologies of vision. And in many of the hoaxes that I'm looking at, in particular the moon hoax that you referenced in your introduction, a great deal of the 17,000-word narrative has to do with the telescope. And it's a make-believe telescope. It's Herschel Jr. It was his father who was really the famous telescope. But purportedly, Herschel II was at the Cape of Good Hope, so someplace really far away, like the tip of South Africa. And he had created this brand new microscope that was even better than his father's, better than Galileo's, better than anybody who had come before him. And it was this technology of vision that allowed him to see the moon. And as I dug into this material, I realized that so many of these hoaxes are dependent upon an emerging form of technology. And I think that they use these technologies in some ways to justify and substantiate what it is they're arguing. And I think at the time there was a prevalent belief in the power of technology, and I think there still is today. So the idea that, oh, somebody built a telescope with this magnificent magnifying power would make it like, oh, well, of course you could see the moon. So there was this desire to believe in the possibility, which to me is the interesting thing, that that's, you know, as these, you know, the descriptions, and they had illustrations, and of course they were drawings of these man-bats who worshipped at these lunar temples, and these really, you know, detailed descriptions of the topography of the moon, and they sounded just like English garden sides. And from the very start, you know, one of the other newspaper editors said, this is not possible. It was supposedly published in the Edinburgh Journal of Science. The Edinburgh Journal of Science went out of business 2 years ago. They haven't even been publishing. There's no way Herschel, who actually was at the Cape of Good Hope, could have done this. But people didn't care, and they ate it up. Right. And even after, and this is the thing that I find really fascinating, is that for years after it had been revealed as a hoax, they still were able to sell, they published it as a standalone volume with these images, and they sold the prints and images of the moonscape as well as the standalone volume for years. So it continued to make money for people, even though people knew it wasn't true. So that's, to me, I don't have the actual answer as to why people believed in these things, but it's this persistence of the suspension of belief that I find really interesting at this particular moment in time. And in this book, I mean, I start back in the 16th century with what is commonly called the Florentine Codex, and I take it up to the, you know, George Halliday's video of the beating of Rodney King. So I'm really interested in what counts as evidence and the relationship between evidence and seeing, and how sometimes people see what they want to believe and sometimes people believe what they see, even if they know that there is no possibility that it's true. So that's what I'm trying to do in this larger project. But the hoax chapter, really, I got really excited. It's really fun material. So we went, I took my kids one summer out to Cooperstown to see the Cardiff Giant, which now you look at it and you think, how could they have possibly thought that was a real skeleton?
Well, walk us through that story, because that was on my list of things to ask you about.
Okay. So the story of the Cardiff Giant is another one of these really interesting hoaxes. And it was a response by a man named Stubb Newell. Well, it was his farm. His brother-in-law, George Hull, was a wealthy tobacconist in Utica in the 1860s. And he was out in Iowa. The story goes he was out in Iowa collecting on a debt, where he got into an argument with an evangelical preacher who was a biblical literalist. And he wanted to prove this guy wrong and say, no, this is, you know, shortly after Darwin publishes The Origin of Species. And he went to really extreme measures, I think, to create this biblical giant, or the skeletal remains, the mummified remains. He went out to Montana, where he bought a giant piece of stone. He told the quarry owner that he was commissioning a statue of Abraham Lincoln, which I think is a funny little detail. And then he had it, like, the stone shipped to Chicago, where he worked with this German immigrant stone cutter to make this petrified man. And they used, funny, they used his body, but they magnified it like 10 times. And it was really, I mean, it has ribs in it, it has full genitalia. And he took, the stone cutter then took knitting needles and poked it and rubbed it with all kinds of material to make it look corroded, and played with lots of acids and dyes to give this sculpture the look of a petrified, you know, human remains that could have been a biblical giant. And so he went and then buried it in the dark of night on his brother-in-law's farm. And then a year later, his brother-in-law, Stubb Newell, commissioned these two workers to dig a well in exactly that place. And of course, they found it. And they went, oh, it's a giant. It's, look at this. And people came from all over. And this, too, was very quickly debunked, but it didn't matter. A group of wealthy businessmen bought that, and they sold views to it. And, Newell and Hull became extremely rich. Then the businessmen who bought it became even richer. Then P.T. Barnum got in on the act, and he wanted to buy it. And the conglomerate who had bought it said, no, 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 it's ours. And then this is, I think, one of the funnier things. Barnum made his own giant and said, right, it was the real giant. And the businessman from Syracuse sued Barnum. And the case actually went to court, and the judge said, actually, no, it was never a real giant. So you cannot sue Barnum for, maligning your giant, because it was actually never real either. But again, this was, people continued to go. And when in the case of this giant, the Cardiff Giant, as well as many of other of Barnum's things, that once they were revealed as hoaxes, people came in droves to see the hoax. So the hoax itself became a spectacle. So fooled once, and then this sort of public, this public participation in the culture of hoaxes is really interesting to me. It's about provoking almost a form of public debate through a sort of sensory experience of first seeing the thing and feeling that sense of wonder and awe, and then going back and saying, ah, shucks, I was fooled. Isn't this interesting? And people went over and over and over again and paid their 50 cents to see this petrified body. So
that is so interesting. And it continues to happen today. I'll admit, I'm fascinated by the Loch Ness Monster. It's not real, but I want to think that it is. I can't explain why.
Yeah, and extraterrestrials, and anytime they find life, and, there is this, I think, this persistent desire to believe in the wonderful and the awesome. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's at the root of it, is we're so subsumed by fact and and rational truth. And I'm not saying, I mean, there are lots of people who believe things that I think, like, how could they possibly believe that? And, you know, some of these Barnum hoaxes, you look at these things and you think, well, of course that wasn't a mermaid.
Right,
you know,
right.
That wasn't a woolly mammoth, you know. But then they did have bones of woolly mammoths. So there was enough real to make the fake seem possible. And that, to me, is that interesting tension.
What about the mermaid? So for our listeners who may not know about the Fiji mermaid, can you paint a picture of what this creature looks like?
It was disgusting. It was repulsive. It was the head of a monkey sewed to the body of a fish. And first of all, think of that in itself. It's disgusting. But then it started to shrivel up, and people then went to go see the hoax. And you can go see it. I don't know if it's actually on view, but it is up in the Peabody Museum at Harvard University now, so Barnum's specimen. And if you Google it and put in Fiji mermaid image, you'll see this nasty-looking thing. It looks nothing like a, it looks nothing like a mermaid. It looks like if you took the head of a taxidermied monkey and sewed it to the tail of a giant fish.
If you're just joining us, my guest for this hour is Joan Saab, Associate Professor of Art History and Visual and Cultural Studies at the University of Rochester. She's talking about her research on the relationship between seeing and believing and how that relates to hoaxes. You can hear more from Joan tonight. She's speaking at Rushree's Library at 5 o'clock as part of the inaugural Nazarian Humanities Lecture Series. In the meantime, you can join the conversation now by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, you can call 263-9994. I'm also on Twitter at MMacMedia if you want to share your questions or comments. Let's get right to the phone. It looks like we have Thomas from Greece. Hi, Thomas.
Yes, thank you. Good show. Hello. I have here this book. This is about a famous misquote, maybe the most one of the most famous in American history. And I have here a book that I would recommend to everybody, Ray Raphael, Founding Myths. Mm. And he brought this quotation out. It was about the famous quote from Patrick Henry, who supposedly said, "Give me liberty or give me death." And the author gives very good evidence that Patrick Henry never said that, that it was written by William Wirt, who was writing a biography of Patrick Henry 42 years after the speech was supposedly given, and he wanted to inspire young men to be patriotic and everything. This was not long after the War of 1812, and so he gave it a very romantic, brave, and defiant a type of description or misquotation, which he said, "Give me liberty or give me death." And the actual speech really just said, called the king a fool, and the British had some very uncomplimentary things to say about the British. And then also, the point he really made was that, Patrick Henry wanted land that the Indians had, and he also wanted to help Virginia money for self-defense, for self-defense militia, so that a supposed slave rebellion would be put down. But he wanted a land outside from the Indians. He'd already bought some land from the Indians, but he wanted the British out of the way so it would be easier for him to get this land from the Indians.
Okay. Thanks, yeah. Thomas. Let me just jump in so Joan can respond to that.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like a fascinating book, and I'll definitely take a look at it. I think one of the things that you point out is that there are often ulterior motives behind these stories and these things that take off. And it's worth our while to dig a little deeper and see that sometimes what appears as a harmless little hoax or a misquotation actually is much deeper and more complicated than that. So thank you very much.
And Thomas, if you continue to listen during our second half hour of the show, we're talking about misattributed quotes specifically related to founding fathers and people from history. So our guest from Monticello will be able to answer even more questions related to that. So your timing is excellent. Joan, going back to your book, what were some of the other examples of technology that made people think that they could believe in some of these hoaxes. We talked about the telescope with the moon hoax.
The microscope also. The microscope is a big one. And even up until today, all sorts of digital technologies. And I have another chapter that looks at photographic, like posed photographs and the idea of photographic truth and how even the earliest photographers manipulated their photographs to reveal and obscure certain things. So I'm interested in reproduction technologies such as the photograph and the film camera, and also technologies like telescopes and microscopes. And I have a sort of coda that I'm trying to decide whether or not to include in the book. It's not finished yet. And it has to do with big data and digital and Twitter and these giant image web crawlers that read photographs. But I'm not sure if what I'm going to do with that yet. I might have enough as it is.
Well, speaking of cameras, I think I'm remembering an example from 1917 or somewhere around there of fairies. Mm-hmm. I think there were a couple of sisters in England and they captured something. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I don't write on that particular episode. But again, fairies, the supernatural, angels, I think it was like 15 years ago, people were taking pictures of angels. And weirdly, those bat-like men that supposedly Herschel saw on the moon, they look remarkably like angels, or what we think in our own, you know, particular Western Judeo-Christian imagination angels might look like. So there's always this desire to capture the supernatural, I think. And I mean, you mentioned the Fox sisters, mm-hmm. you know, seances, communing with the dead. And this particular area, it was known as the burned over district because of so many religions that swept through it, that burned through it. And so many of these things were rooted here. And of course, they go hand in hand with these technological developments like the Erie Canal and all sorts of other steam power and other industrial monuments to the age. So I think that they're richly intertwined.
What do you think is your favorite example of the most modern hoax that people continue to believe in? If you had to choose one.
I was going
to
say Donald Trump, but I think that'll get me into trouble. I don't know. I think that, you know, I don't know if I should call it a hoax, but all of those people who are using, you know, infrared technologies to figure out where Noah's Ark landed. And they're not really hoaxes, but they're attempts, much like the petrified giant, to literalize certain stories from the past. And so people are using all sorts of infrared technologies and x-ray technologies to see through things and into things, to reveal things that they believe are there that may or may not be. So I find those sorts of things very interesting in terms of contemporary hoaxing moments. And there's lots of them. I mean, they just proliferate the more you look. But then you see real things, like the Chinese I read last week just developed a super telescope that can see like farther than any other telescope in the world. So all of these things are seemingly possible too. So that for me is the richness of this material, is that you think they're impossible. You think it's crazy that these things could do this. And then you read an example of something that actually did happen. And it's sifting through this material and making sense of what is real, and I put that in quotation marks, square quotes, and what is not, because it's hard to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. So for your lecture tonight, what can people expect if they come to Rushree's Library, the Hawkins-Carlson Room at 5:00? What will they hear? What types of stories will you be sharing?
Many of the stories that I've talked about now, I'm very interested in, as I said, the relationship between people's desire to believe in a certain type of possibility. I'm interested in, so one of the things that I'm trying to stress in this talk is something that we don't take as seriously as we used to, and that is that sense of wonder or that sense of awe. And I think that for me, that's a really valuable emotion or intellectual position to be in, is a sense of curiosity. And this particular series is, as you said, it's the inaugural lecture in a series that's being funded by our new Humanities Center. And I think the reason I chose to talk about this at this particular moment in time is because it feeds this idea of the importance of the humanities and at this moment to create a sense of awesomeness or wonder in people, so that people ask questions and don't take things as absolutely true but believe that they could potentially be true. And I think it's that fine line between the possibility of truth and the absolute nature of fact that I'm trying to get at, that gray area in between.
Mm-hmm. And remind our listeners one more time where they can find you tonight.
At the University of Rochester in the Hawkins Carlson Room. It's the inaugural Nazarian Humanity Center Lectures.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take this conversation a step further and explore some misquotations. And I see some calls coming in. I've got Gary in Rochester with a question about misquotes and hoaxes. Gary, stay on the line for us. We'll get right to you. We'll be right back after this short break. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking Super Bowl ads. The game was about a month ago, and we want to know which commercials still stand out in your mind. It's an important question for advertisers measuring the effectiveness of their ads. They want to know if that $5 million 30-second spot is still worth the cost. We'll talk about which ads worked, which failed, and how the industry is changing. That's all next hour. Stay with us. Welcome back to Connections. I'm producer Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We've been talking about hoaxes and the relationship between seeing and believing with Joan Saab, Associate Professor of Art History and Visual and Cultural Studies at the University of Rochester. Now let's explore some recent incidents that can teach us something about hearing or reading and believing. I'm talking about spurious quotes. Now, if you've been paying attention to the presidential race, you may have noticed that there have been some falsely attributed quotes, some quotes that have been falsely attributed to our founding fathers, namely Thomas Jefferson. He's quoted incorrectly across the political spectrum, not just during the presidential race, but so much so that the staff at Monticello are keeping track of all these mistakes. And joining us on the line now is Anna Burks, a research librarian at the Jefferson Library at Monticello. Anna, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And before we talk about Jefferson, let's talk about you for a second. You're a Rochester native.
I am. I'm actually from Webster.
Very good. I didn't know that when I called, and I was very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, it was a total coincidence.
There you go. So, Anna, you've been tracking false quotes for a while now. How do you do that? How do you find these quotes across the public spectrum?
Well, sometimes they come to me. Sometimes people will email us or call us and ask us about a quote that they've seen or heard in the media. Sometimes we see them. I have a Google alert set up so that I can see, you know, when people are mentioning Jefferson on the internet, and so I'll get an email every day. And sometimes we spot new spurious quotes that way. So all different ways, you know, they come at us all the time.
And because they're coming at you all the time, you've created this web page listing all of the quotes that you're finding that are misleading or incorrect. Can you tell us a little bit about that website?
Yeah, that was sort of out of necessity, really. We were getting so many questions about this that we thought it would be useful to just put all this information that we were gathering up on our website so that people could find it for themselves. And actually, it did have that effect where, the questions flow has slowed down now that we have all this spurious quotes information on our website. But, you know, new ones do come along every now and then, and they do sort of surprise me.
I have so many questions calling in about incorrect quotes. So let's go to the
phones. Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. This is Gary in Rochester. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Actually, I'm glad you have this caller from Monticello. I've used that website many times, so thank you for doing that.
Oh, thank you. That's great to hear.
Okay. And my question relates to the quotes, and here's two others that Gandhi never said, be the change, and that Martin Luther King said that the arc of justice bends towards, arc of the universe bends towards justice. He was actually quoting a Unitarian minister named Theodore Parker. But my question is this, is when we talk about this in relation to hoaxes, you know, those are sometimes misquotations. And again, I could relate it to a little bit of what you talked about, religions. And at what point does something go from being a misquote or a myth to becoming a hoax? I guess, does a hoax require an intentional deception for it to actually qualify as a hoax? Because I think a lot of the misquotes we're talking about is people aren't really necessarily trying to deceive someone. A myth doesn't necessarily try to. nor does it, and we talked about the burned out district, nor do religious beliefs try to deceive, so to speak, unless you're Elmer Gantry. But could you talk a little bit about at what point does something become a hoax? Thanks.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's the intention behind it. It's an intentionality. And I'm thinking back to Barnum again and his notion of a humbug. And he says of a humbug that it's generally defined as a deceit or an imposition. It's taking an old truth and putting it in a more attractive form. And I think it's that switch of taking an old truth, a misquote would be that. But the deceit, the humbug or the hoax is the intentionality of sort of changing the form of it with the desire to trick people. I think you're absolutely right. I think sometimes things are mistakes, but once the mistake is acknowledged but maintained, that for me is the moment it slips into the hoaxy category.
Anna, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I would just say that rarely actually do I see people intentionally misquoting Jefferson. Really, it usually is someone who wants to, they want to be right, but they're not intentionally misquoting Jefferson. They just don't realize that it's not something that he said. Very, very occasionally, you will find people who don't back down when it's pointed out that they're using a misquote. So at that point, it's like, well, might start to cross over into a gray area there. But for the most part, people just don't realize that they're misquoting someone.
I was going to ask you, Anna, if you thought it had something to do with the misquoter's notion of credibility, that somehow or another quoting Jefferson bestows on them a certain type of persona, or...
But... Yeah, I think there's definitely a weight to having Jefferson, added to your argument, and I think that's part of the reason why these are kind of attractive to people, that they want to include them in their arguments or whatever. Jefferson definitely has a lot of weight to his name. And I think that's part of the reason why you see quotes that were usually said by people who are a lot less famous as, Jefferson. They tend to sort of drift away and glom on to people that are more famous. It's just this sort of fascinating process that happens with spurious quotes a lot of the time. They will just, they get disassociated from the people who originally said them, and they get attached to famous names. There's a book by a guy named Ralph Keyes. It's called Nice Guys Finish Seventh, and he talks a lot about spurious quotes. And he calls these flypaper people, so people like Jefferson or Mark Twain is another one, Ben Franklin, Abraham Lincoln, people who are quoted a lot. And because they are so famous and they're sort of known for being very eloquent, wise people, they just tend to attract spurious quotes. It's a really interesting phenomenon.
Anna, we have a couple questions coming in through Twitter about the name of the website. Can you tell people how to find that list?
We are at www.monticello.org, and that's MONTICELLO. And you can just go there and search for spurious quotes, and they'll come right up.
Thank you. Let's stop and take a look at a couple examples. I want to preface this by saying that this is not a discussion about politics. We're not taking any political angle. These are just some of the most talked about examples of misquoting Thomas Jefferson recently. So this first cut is from John Oliver's show, and he is talking about misquotations and some recent statements by Ben Carson.
Mm-hmm. Quotations. Yeah. The carrier. Quotations make us sound smart. That's why politicians love throwing them around. In fact, just recently, Ben Carson decided to quote a founding father.
Thomas Jefferson himself said, gun control works great for the people who are law-abiding citizens, and it does nothing for the criminals, and all it does is put the people at risk.
I'm pretty sure Jefferson did not say that, in part because the term gun control wasn't even used in its modern sense until the 1960s. Now, to be fair, the gist of the quote does appear in Jefferson's handwriting, but it was apparently a paraphrased quote from Italian philosopher Cesare Beccaria that Jefferson had copied into his journal. And you cannot give people credit for saying things they copied into notebooks. Otherwise, my teenage self would have been able to claim credit for the Pythagorean theorem and most Smashing Pumpkins lyrics.
So that's John Oliver, and I see Joan cracking up here in the studio. Anna, what are your first reactions to that?
Well, that's a quote that we dealt with long ago. And actually, that one has a little bit more legitimacy than others that I've seen that just have absolutely nothing to do with Jefferson. This one, it is something that he did write in one of his commonplace books. So there is a tie. It's just that people have sort of gotten confused about how it actually relates to Jefferson himself.
Mm-hmm. And so it's not just Ben Carson. Presidents Obama and Clinton have misquoted Lincoln in the past. Rand Paul has been criticized for misquoting or using fake quotes or taking quotes from the Founding Fathers out of context in two of his books. I'm sure that's something that you've come across recently, Anna.
Yes.
It seems that the quote, "eternal vigilance is the price of liberty," seems to be something that's often misused. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've logged that and you're tracking how it's misused over time?
Well, that's actually a really old, spurious quote. And, you know, a lot of them are, as far as I can tell, relatively new. You know, they sort of appeared on the internet in, you know, the 2000s, the aughts or something. And you can't really track them back earlier than that. But eternal vigilance is the price of liberty is a really, really old one. And it was already being attributed to Jefferson in the 18-teens, so when he was still alive. And you can sort of see how it was originally quoted in newspapers and given its true source, which is John Philpot Curran, who's an Anglo-Irish, I think, politician. And then gradually you see it appearing without his name. The party that was related to Jefferson, the Republicans or Democratic Republicans, they sort of appropriated this. And before long, they started attributing it to Jefferson. So you can sort of see in the newspapers of the time this process of it's sort of floating away from Curran and becoming attached to Jefferson. And ever since, it's sort of been repeated as something that Jefferson said. So that one has a really fascinating history.
Are there others that you think are equally as fascinating? Is there one that's sort of your favorite to deal with on a daily basis?
I don't know about favorite. I mean, that's definitely one of the more interesting ones. I mean, there are some quotes that I think may have started out as jokes that, you know, I can't really document that, but I think, you know, maybe it was somebody just having some fun and then, you know, other people read it and thought, oh, Jefferson said that? Really? So, you know, there are some quotes about, you know, smoking hemp, you know, things like that, you know, just are complete, you know, modern creations. And, you know, we see these being attributed to Jefferson, and you just kind of have to laugh.
We have a question from Jake. He emailed the program at connections@wxxi.org. He says he frequently sees the Founding Fathers misquoted, as we're talking about. And this is the quote that he's seeing specifically. Quote, "The Bible is not my book, and Christianity is not my religion. I could never give assent to the long, complicated statements of Christian dogma." And that's attributed to Abraham Lincoln. So Jake says, "My research indicates he may have said, the Bible is not my book, and Christianity is not my profession. And the balance of the quote is a fabrication." Anna, do you have any background knowledge on that particular quote or where that might have come from?
I don't. I'd be interested to hear more about it, though. It's fascinating that the switch that takes place between what he thinks is the correct sentence and how it's, you know, taken off and then probably deployed.
Mm-hmm. Anna, any background on that?
Sorry. We're all Jefferson all the time here, so I don't have much time to research Lincoln quotes, but I am generally aware that other famous figures have their own problems with quotes being falsely attributed to them. But that you know, there are definitely quotes like that with Jefferson that are kind of a combination of, you know, partly true, and then they have something that's completely spurious tacked onto it. So that's totally possible that what your caller is suggesting is that's what's happening with this quote.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about hoaxes, false quotes, and why people believe them to be true. My guests are Joan Saab, Associate Professor of Art History and Visual and Cultural Studies at the University of Rochester, and Anna Burks, Research Librarian at Monticello, and she's been tracking spurious Jefferson quotes. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, you can call 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I'm also on Twitter at MMacMedia, or you can email the program at connections@WXXI.org. So I'd like to talk about the internet for a second, because we have this beautiful medium through which we can communicate anything, but create so many problems for us. So Joan and Anna, if you can weigh in on what you think is the biggest problem that the internet poses to creating these hoaxes and making things more misleading than they could be otherwise. So fonts, maybe memes and graphics, like if you present something in a certain way, people may perceive it as to be real because it looks credible. The way it's presented looks credible. Have you come across any of those examples in your research?
Well, one of the things, I mean, I think this, one of the points I'm trying to make in the project I'm working on now is that this predates the internet, this connection between seeing and believing. So the New York Sun publishes an account that was supposedly published in the Edinburgh Journal of Science to legitimate what they already knew was not true in order to sell more newspapers. And so this idea, it was in a newspaper, it must be true, goes back to the early 19th century. I think there are tons of sites today online, whether they're medical sites or news sites or entertainment sites, that there's just so many more of them. So it becomes much more difficult for us to try to figure out what are legitimate sources of information and what may not be. And sometimes, I don't know, like if you read gossip things, sometimes the true stories show up on these crazy gossip sites and it ends up, you know, being true, whereas sometimes papers of records get things wrong. And I think because of that, we, again, have to juggle what we think we know and what we're being presented with. And it gets difficult. And I think people then don't want to do that work. And so they're more willing to believe what they see than they may not have been. But then there are other people who are even more skeptical because of that. So I think the pendulum swings both ways with regards to the internet.
Mm-hmm. Anna, did you want to weigh in on how the internet can frame the credibility of a quote from Jefferson?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, like you said, it's a wonderful medium. But, you know, back in the days of print, things moved more slowly. And so the issue that one of the issues that the internet brings up is that not only is it so much more information, it's moving so quickly, and people can just copy and paste in seconds. So a quote can be, you know, literally spread all over the internet in, you know, a matter of hours. Whereas, you know, back in the days of no internet and just books and newspapers, you know, that process would be a lot slower. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's easier to track as well if it's only in print. Whereas websites they're very hard to track. It's hard to date them. So in some ways, you know, it's easy for us to get on the internet and do searches. So in that regard, it's an important tool for me for searching down quotes, but it also it's a very, it's kind of like the Wild West in terms of, you know, control. You don't know how old the website is. You don't know who sometimes is putting up the information on a website, where they got it. So it's it presents some challenges. I'm glad we have it, but it's also a medium where people, a lot of people have difficulty judging what they see. Mm-hmm. And sometimes even people will tell me, I don't trust anything on the internet. And that's sort of going too far the other way, I think. You know, I think most people are not, they have difficulty telling whether they should trust something on the internet or not. And that's a really big problem. It's good to be skeptical, but people also need to develop sort of their toolbox of being able to judge whether things are credible or not. And that's the basic problem, I think.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about that on shows that we've done on libraries here on Connections before, how the value of libraries continues to be important. And you can't just Google everything and expect everything to be true. Of course, there are journals available through Google, but as you said, Anna, it's you need those basic research skills and that basic filter to be able to judge. Looks like the phones are lighting up again. Let's go to Keith in Canandaigua. Hi, Keith.
Interesting show. Got a quick comment. When it comes to quotes, again, to quote something, I heard that if you say a lie, if you repeat a lie loud enough and long enough, eventually becomes the truth. Now, not sure if that's true, but in some instances, I would say it is true. And when you go to hoaxes, that's somewhat complicated because hoaxes have to work on people's belief. Me, I consider myself a consummate cynic, so if somebody makes a claim, I want them to prove it. But if you go back through history, people always want answers. And if the answer has to be, if the answer to the question is not true or based on a belief or a hoax, if that's what people want to believe, then it becomes the truth and just gets perpetuated.
Thanks, Keith. I'll turn that over to Joan and Anna. Any thoughts about repeating a quote enough times so it seems to become truth? Is there weight in the frequency of which it's used?
I have actually seen people claim that, you know, when it was pointed out that a quote they were using was spurious, their comeback was, well, you know, there's 80 million people saying it on the internet, so it must be, that's literally what they said. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, that's, quantity does not equal quality. So it's really, yeah, that's a problem. There's also, I mean, people have a huge confirmation bias problem. So, you know, people see something that fits in with their beliefs that they already have, and they're much less likely to question it. So I think that's another factor that goes on here.
Or you go looking for something that falls within your frame of mind and you attach
right.
yourself to it.
Yeah.
And Joan's nodding. I'll let you jump in, Joan.
Yeah, I know the example of the Cardiff Giant is a perfect one there because both there are these two schools of geology, the Neptunists and the Plutonists, and they both saw this giant as evidence that they were right about the way that the world began. Did it begin with a giant flood, as, you know, put forth in the Bible, or was it, you know, molten rock and all sorts of tectonic shifts, et cetera? And they both were able to use this particular hoax, which in the end wasn't either, to substantiate their worldviews. So I think the caller is absolutely right that these types of hoaxes usually take places at times when people are anxious about something that's been rattled. And in the instances I'm looking at, they tend to be major technological or philosophical things. You know, the origin of species rattled people's belief system. The location of, you know, planets in the solar system through the telescope really caused a number of larger philosophical and epistemological earthquakes because, oh, all of a sudden we know that, you know, the way the universe works is different than the way many people believed it had before. So it shakes their foundations. And I think that, as Anna and others have said, it's the desire to see what you want to believe to make you feel better in a time of uncertainty and potentially enormous change.
Or what about making you feel worse? I'm thinking of the War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938. The exact opposite. People mm-hmm. are latching onto something that isn't true, but they don't know. Did you want to speak about that, the Orson Welles broadcast?
It makes you feel worse for a moment, but then you feel better afterwards, right? And I think that, I mean, I wonder, like, I've been looking at these Barnum freaks, and I think, like, why do people go to these? And I think it, on one hand, it was to make people feel like, oh, I don't have it so bad, right? At least I'm not the, you know, whatever, Wolfman or the... So I think that there's simultaneously this desire to feel both better and say, oh, phew, thank goodness, not me.
Mm-hmm. Anna, does that come up in researching the quotes at all? Or are people attaching themselves to certain quotes and latching onto them aggressively to further their own personal ideology? Are there examples of that that you can share?
Well, what I was going to say is I think there is also a comfort factor in Jefferson quotes. I think that when people see a quote that matches up with their beliefs, and they see Jefferson's name attached to it, I think that on some level it can be comforting for people. And, of course, in the end, it's not something that Jefferson said, but to believe that it is something that he said is something that people want, and that's a lot of the power of spurious quotes right there.
How much of your day do you spend tracking and researching these spurious quotes?
Actually, not a lot now. I used to spend a great deal of time on this, and putting up all the information on our website was a lot of work. Right now, it's just, like I said, you know, every once in a while we'll find a new quote, and I'll devote maybe 2 or 3 hours to researching it and composing something for the website, and then it's, you know, it's done until, you know, a few years later, I need to sort of revisit quotes because new things are appearing on the internet all the time, and new things are being published. So I sort of need to check in with them as well. So it's a sort of a low-grade maintenance thing that I do most of the time now.
Are you one of a team of people that are tracking those, or are you a one-man band?
Yes, I'm a one woman.
One woman band.
Yeah, it's all me. That's just me.
Oh, my goodness. I think we have time for one more call. And let's see, who do we have on line one? Oh, we're having, here we go. It's coming. Thank you. Bill from Victor. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I wanted to comment on the difficulty in our society in determining who is the arbiter of what is true. Whether it's regarding quotes or anything else. And in the political arena, going back to things that Spiro Agnew, President Nixon's vice president, said back in the day, which began the maligning of elitism, which has led to the point where in a lot of people's minds, the opinion of someone at, say, Princeton or Stanford or wherever, who has studied a certain subject for 40 or 50 years, that their opinion has no more substance or value than something that just popped into the head of a talk show host. And that conservative think tanks have been consistently putting out this this message that expert opinion is not to be trusted, the elites are not to be trusted, and this, you know, this has been the case since the Ivy League schools that once were the very bastion of conservatism.
Bill, I'm sorry, I got to jump in because we're almost out of time, so I want to throw that over to Joan and Anna for any quick responses they might have. Thanks for calling in, Bill. Any quick thoughts? We're down to about a minute.
My first response is to say you're absolutely correct. I think that, and I think it goes back to what the previous caller said too, is that people want to believe what they want to believe, even if there are these team of, you know, experts in the field who say, no, that's not how, you know, things developed. They're more willing to take, well, I trust this person more. I don't know that person. They're an educated, you know, egghead, elitist, you know, Ivy League professor. they don't have my interests at heart. And of course they don't. They're interested in whatever it is they're studying. They may have their interests at heart. I don't know, but that's not their job. They might be studying geology or astronomy or whatever it is they're studying. So I think that Bill's absolutely right. I think that it goes back to, yes, at least the 60s, if not before then.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We are out of time, unfortunately. We had so many questions come in. Thank you. I'd like to thank our guests, too, Anna Burks from the Jefferson Library at Monticello. Anna, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
And Joan Saab, Associate Professor of Art History and Visual and Cultural Studies at the University of Rochester. Remind our listeners again where they can find you tonight.
At the University of Rochester Library at 5 o'clock.
Thank you. Next up on Connections, does puppy baby monkey ring a bell? We're talking about Super Bowl ads and how the advertising industry is changing. More Connections next.